My topic tonight is entitled True and False Ecumenism in the Church in Light of Karl Barth's Questions at an Apostolic Threshold. And I'd like to begin and perhaps deepen somewhat a word from Yves Congar. Polemic, however, if it is accurate, loyal, and irenic, can be a form of dialogue, end quote. Ecumenical discourse and the uses of history. In his untimely reflections on the use and abuse of history, Friedrich Nietzsche distinguished three forms of history, the utility of which for our own present and future lives is said to depend in part on how certain limited forms of remembering the past are matched to certain limited forms of forgetting it. Nietzsche identified the three forms of history as monumental, antiquarian, and critical senses. Karl Barth's visit to Rome exactly 50 years ago this week and his questions for a Roman Catholicism that in the Second Vatican Council had just sought to reorient itself call for our reflection on all three forms of history, since each of them enters into ecumenical discourse in ways both useful and detrimental. First of all, then, monumental history. What I'll do in this talk is, first of all, I'll give you these three senses of history in order to pose the problem of what ecumenism might need to do to become even better. And then in the second half, I'll take three other distinctions coming from Congar and apply them to Barth and see how he's shown us how we can develop the third sense of history, namely the critical sense of history. What Nietzsche calls monumental or exemplary history demands a double forgetting, a forgetting of some of the weaknesses that conditioned the great figures and discourses of the past, and a forgetting of some of our worries that because of our own weaknesses, we could never measure up to those whose greatness we commemorate, that we could increase, at least in our own eyes, only if they could be diminished, kind of counter-Baptist logic there. This failure to set aside some of our self-doubts shows itself in the dynamics of ecumenical dialogue, in the familiar tactic which suggests that we can reach an amicable understanding with one another today only by claiming that earlier opponents had to a large degree simply misunderstood one another. Unlike ourselves, they did not speak to one another's real concerns. An example. Some of the most prominent studies that prepared the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification at the end of the last century made programmatic this claim of misunderstanding as the first step towards rapprochement that identified the criticized as nicht getroffen in German, as not hit, not understood, that the criticisms were not applicable. The conflictual partner was not even touched by the critique of his or her opponents. Against the trend of other historical disciplines, which had tended to suspect division beneath apparent harmony and yet despite certain dementis, harmony was asserted here beneath the apparent conflict with such programmatic consistency that the more historically oriented critics of the new harmony were obliged to retrace how the positions of the 16th century were in fact in serious conflict. By suggesting that our understanding today would demand the widespread mutual misunderstanding of earlier disputants, the path towards reconciliation had become longer and more arduous. Admittedly, not every self-doubt vis-a-vis history and our history is destructive. There can be something salutary, for example, in the trepidation about speaking at a symposium which seeks to form a synthetic theological judgment about the remarkable, if imperfect, event that was the Second Vatican Council, and about the remarkable, if imperfect, theologian that was Karl Barth, above all, about what was remarkable, if imperfect, critical, irenic conversation between the two and what it might tell us about the dynamics of an ecumenism that might improve upon much of what has become habitual today, hopeful that we can learn from the strengths, but even from the weaknesses of these conversations in the 1960s, and that without diminishing the strengths or hiding from the weaknesses of official or less official efforts at ecumenical conversation since then. We need enough of monumental history to recognize the abiding significance for all of Christianity of the conflicts of the 16th century. To be dismissive of those conflicts and their importance would not only diminish the importance of half of Western Christianity, but would in fact be an impoverishment of Christianity as a whole. So with that, I come to antiquarian history. Marking his own departure from the conventional scope of classical philology, Nietzsche shows the least sympathy and the most bitter irony for what he calls antiquarian history. It appears to him the least useful, for it forgets the forest for the trees, misses the significance of historical context by excessive devotion to their concrete details, gives its, quote, conserving and venerating soul, end quote, over to often well-researched but minor features of the past that it portrays as a prescriptive template for our present and future existence. Antiquarian history is, in this sense, less interested in advancing the spirit of the past than in copying its letter and trying to feel at home within it. One might assume in an ecumenical conversation sponsored by the Thomistic Institute and the Center for Barth Studies that antiquarian history is, in this sense, describes a theological vice familiar only to Roman Catholic scholars. Admittedly, it is a vice from which Barth himself, John Calvin, and Reformed theology generally, given their greater ease with the hermeneutic of suspicion about their own traditions, are in comparison to classically Catholic schools of theology relatively free. One of the best philosophical accounts of the need to move beyond antiquarian history and even the effective history of Wirkungsgeschichte for a more self-critical blend of both memory and forgetting, namely the late work of Paul Ricoeur on memory, history, and forgetting, reflects the legacy of Calvin's dialectic of justification and salvation. And yet, perhaps in order to irritate you, I want to give you two examples of where I think the Reformational theology has had too much antiquarian history, and two examples where I want to argue that Catholic theology has had too little of it. So for all of what I had just said, the temptation to antiquarianism is no stranger to theologians of the various Reformational traditions. The antiquarian spirit that Nietzsche describes breathes again, for example, in recent appeals for a programmatically non-critical use of history and narrative, including identity-establishing myths, a term borrowed from the texts, they say, from the Calvin Jubilee of 2009, by the recent ecumenically abstinent basic text or Grundlagentext of the Evangelical Church in Germany for the Luther celebrations around the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, Justification, and Freedom. Despite the passing acknowledgement of the need for an appropriate balance between tradition and innovation, the programmatic focus of this organizational plan is the affirmation of familiar, if admittedly fictional, narratives of the early years of the Reformation, identity-establishing myths. The spirit of antiquarian history is perceptible as well in the nearly exclusive goal of Donald Norwood's conversational study of the topic of this conference in his Reforming Rome, Karl Barth and Vatican II, in which the benchmark of theological progress, including Barth's own, appears to be the growing conformity to the more familiar features of Reformational theology and practice. Admonitions of the Roman Catholic ecumenical partners and the call for their transformation to an established alternative are isolated here from other ecumenical tasks, key ecumenical tasks, such as the affirmative discovery of the other or sustained attempts at self-reform. The neglect of the theme of self-reform as a task for each partner in ecumenical dialogue distinguishes Norwood's study from Barth's essay of 1963, Thoughts on the Second Vatican Council, which the English translation has added to Ad Limine Apostolorum. Reflecting on the tumultuous events of the first session of the Council, Barth notes here, the way to unity of the Church can only be the way of her renewal, but renewal means repentance, and repentance means turning about, not the turning of those others, but one's own turning. Barth presents here a notion of ecumenism, quote, quite freed from the thought that the brethren separated from us might become evangelical in our sense and style, end quote. But there are also two, perhaps, failures to antiquarian history on the Catholic side that have not too much, but too little. By contrast, Roman Catholic perspectives on history do often incorporate, but need not restrict themselves to, and may not restrict themselves to, something like the antiquarian use of history. Close attention to the Roman Catholic past discovers at times instances of greater affinity to the initial reformational stress on grace, faith, revelation, and Christ than what is to be found in some of the more notable trends in Roman Catholic teaching and practice. It is here that conciliar ressourcement has and still has its particular place. A second questionable tactic, not uncommon in several important ecumenical efforts since the Council, has been to follow the claim of earlier misunderstandings with the complementary assertion that even where the confessions back then might have generally disagreed about something or other in the 16th century, these differences no longer exist today, at least not on matters that could divide the Church, the famous debate about Grunddissens. One of the many problems with this tactic is that it passes too quickly over too many of the counterexamples of divisions that arguably have become not smaller, but greater with time. The response prepared in 1992 by the Protestant faculty in Göttingen for the emerging Catholic-Lutheran agreement on justification identified several issues of this kind, such as the dominant priesthood of the local bishop, that in the wake of Vatican II had become rather more than less defining for the Roman Catholic community. A further example, perhaps, of having in the Roman Catholic area too little antiquarian history. In 1966, a group of Dominican friars, at least in part, if not entirely, from the Curia at Santa Sabina, but in the absence of the participant at the council, Master Anicedo Fernandez, tried to impress Bart during the Roman visit by identifying themselves emphatically with positions of a then still fashionable Jesuit theology that the Jesuits themselves, among others, Juan Alfaro, told Bart they were beginning to question. The Dominican friars boast that they were all followers of Teilhard and therefore rejected any apocalyptic view of the eschaton that saw salvation coming from above rather than in Ronarian terms from as evolving from below as the fruition and harvest of free human deeds, predictably failed to impress Bart, who, despite the humorous description of the marvelous rooftop balcony at the Gregoriana as a pinnacle or cinna, which is presumably a playful reference to the second temptation of Christ in the fourth chapters of Luke and Matthew, it's the only place where cinna comes up, and it's not a cinna, it's a dark balcony, it's flat. Anyway, but probably despite this playful point that Bart brings, he found the discussions with the Jesuits up there to be, in a more important sense, the high point, content-wise, of his Roman visit. The accommodating and well-meaning friars might have done better to recall the Thomistic tradition, which towards the end of the 16th century was denounced as crypto-Calvinist, so it's a terrible accusation, but was denounced as crypto-Calvinist, but that, if freed from antiquarianism, could have better understood Barth's intentions as explained in Heron's Vestigiis lecture, to which Krongar would invite him and which is now also included in this little volume, Ad Limina Apostolorum, from after the council. They would then have been better able to follow the traces of both the Tridentinum and the Second Council of Orange with their pronouncements on grace and election to the point where their paths join and head in a direction less counter to Barth's own. The friars' fear of antiquarianism had led them in a direction that was less ecumenical and, as discussions on justification 20 years later would show, also less up-to-date. A further example would be the Roman Catholic semi-secret evaluation done at the time of the discussion on justification and included in the common official statement as the first modern source for that declaration. It was a semi-secret because the Papal Council on Promoting Christian Unity had asked for it to be done, but they wouldn't tell anyone whom they had asked, who the authors were, and it was one of those burn-after-reading documents that couldn't be published and never was, and yet it is given as one of the official sources for this document. But it begins with a beginner's mistake from Thomas Aquinas with the Secunda Secundae article in the Secunda Secundae about faith. The faith, we heard it referred to tonight once already, is belief in the first truth and not in enunciations, but that for which you would flunk a student. They didn't mention the second article, which says we are closer to the first truth by having enunciations because we are animals with language. But that wasn't in it. And from this sort of relativization of all differences, because we all believe in the first truth, they then drew many kinds of conclusions to encourage the standpoint of the Papal Council. And they didn't pass this on to the congregation because they said it was private, but then they brought it back in as an official source in the final document. It means that in principle, almost, there could be no serious difference, and perhaps it's a development of the Rana Fries plan from 9 years before that, which more or less said there is transcendental unity and just categorical differences, and those categorical differences in that read, which is not Rana's only one, but in that read, is not so important. So it seems like a development of that logic. If you want to read some ideas about it, Eilert Herms wrote at that time A Certain Reaction, which is very Eilert Herms, but also has perhaps even a wider kind of interest for others. Good. Yet even where, say it occurred, the growing convergence of theology or pastoral practice increasing after the 16th century is of itself not yet a guarantee of the deeper commitment to grace, faith, revelation, or Christ. The chronic vigor and the steady transformation of the Ecclesia Semper Reformanda, or Zuma Gensim said, Semper Purificanda, Semper Augenda, is a necessary but not a sufficient condition of genuine development. Indeed, one of the many reasons for Roman Catholic theologians to study Reformed theology is to better locate the genuinely Roman Catholic possibilities of discerning developments from corruptions, even in recent and dominant trends of Roman Catholic thought and practice, including the varied aspects of its recent ecumenical dynamics, the methods and goals of which to date need not be viewed as the new prize of antiquarian rigor. Methodus oecumenica est semper reformanda. And with that, I would like to come to the third type of history in Nietzsche, and the most important for our topic, that of critical history. The Roman Catholic proponents of the need to transcend the limitations of antiquarian history without simply forgetting the past have not always found theirs an easy task. John Henry Newman had anticipated Nietzsche's critique of antiquarian history by insisting that the necessary continuity in the principles of faith requires at some point a kind of limited forgetting or discontinuity regarding some of the earlier concrete doctrinal formulations of those principles. The preservation of a type of Christian existence, say of intercessory prayer, demands at times novelty in its outward practice. Genesis implies always a certain stasis. Matthew 16:25 reminds us that at times the very attempt to save a form of life can lose it. Newman illustrates how precisely the failure to develop by this mix of memory and forgetting had, to use Nietzsche's terms, amounted to the kind of antiquarian abuse of history that can in the end destroy all that had so admirably grown up in the past and the common, if hidden, roots that could foster further growth into the future. Even prior to the council, Yves Congar had ordered his vast, if you like antiquarian, his vast and detailed reading of patristic and medieval sources around a sense of development constructed, as he tells us, in his preconciliar study on true and false reform in the church, with insights drawn from Newman, Johann Adam Müller, and Thomas Aquinas. In this work, Congar identified two forms of false reform in unambiguous antiquarianism and unambiguous revolution. like the later hermeneutic of reform for reading the text of the Second Vatican Council, true reform in Congar's sense must live with the ambiguity and take up the synthetic task of holding and thinking together continuity and discontinuity. Both would find their place in the agreed compromise text of the Council, or in terms that Newman takes from Müller, Gegensätze without Widersprüche, that is to say, non-contradictory opposites that have developed over time. Steal some of this water, comment. Recalling a brief but priceless exchange, as he describes it, on Mariology between Rahner and Ratzinger during his Roman visit, to which Barth also refers in his final question on Lumen Gentium, he relates to Eberhard Busch his impression that, quote, "One noticed in this exchange how thoroughly trained the Catholics are in dialectical differentiating thought, so that opposites are not really opposites, but differences, complementing rather than excluding one another. Here and elsewhere, the same line was repeated time and again. We need to distinguish here." Despite his greater ease with clear-cut contradiction, Barth, too, arguably had his own way of practicing this art. With praise and criticism of such important sources as Calvin or Kierkegaard, and, of course, even of Karl Barth, admittedly as complex persons and not just as one individual thesis. A studiously ambivalent stance towards the past comes closer, perhaps, to the best potential of what Nietzsche described as the third or critical use of history. The destructive element in Nietzsche's own passionate desire to overcome the legacy of the post-heroic past for the sake of a bold new future, a very questionable one, goes beyond what all but the most aggressive of ecumenists would intend for the established Christian traditions. In his amicable and largely harmonious conversations with Hans Küng immediately before and after the trip to Rome, Barth gladly makes his own a number of questions and viewpoints suggested by Küng, notably in his soon-to-be-published book on the Church, including the inversion of the hierarchical pyramid, the apology to Muslims, the prefigurement of the Roman Catholic Church simply in the limited fraction around Kephas, the description of the different fractions at and after Vatican II, and the primacy among papal titles of Servus Servorum, which Barth then included in the dedication for each of the four opuscula that he presented to Paul VI during the visit. At the same time, Barth expressed criticism of Küng's liberal adoption of the divorce of the Christ of faith from the Jesus of history, and worry about his lack of distance from troubling developments within Protestant theology. Following a visit by Jan Willebrands and Johannes Feiner in Basel to prepare Barth's trip to Rome, during which the two visitors spoke inter alia for an elimination of the custom of praying the rosary and of the doctrine of transubstantiation, Barth expresses more concern than his compatriot that, quote, "for the reform wing of Catholicism, everything is in motion," end quote, and that the Roman community might be collapsing, as he says, like an animal without bones or a ship without nails. Even after the critical remarks by Willebrands, though, Barth is still skeptical that Küng's proclamation that Marian and Mariological discourse is now just a mausoleum had met widespread acceptance in the Roman Catholic community. Despite their many points of agreement, Barth, quote, "worries about a modernist liberal trend in the reforming wing of Catholicism," end quote. Barth's choice of beginning in Rome with questions rather than with counter-theses is in part due to his conviction that, quote, "things in Protestantism, things are no better at the moment than in all the commotion of contemporary Catholicism," end quote. And his critique is therefore less destructive than Nietzsche's in its intent. Although Benjamin Dahlke's recent study on Karl Barth, Catholic Renewal and Vatican II, barely mentions the conversation between Congar and Barth, the case of Congar would only have confirmed what is arguably one of the great strengths of Dahlke's study, its insight into how much of the dynamic and ecumenical discourse is a result of intramural controversies among theologians on each side about what to retain and what to dismiss within their own faith tradition. How this has impacted the understanding of Barth and his place within Reformational theology today will be a question especially for the Protestant colleagues at this symposium. Catholic readings of the Council, following the historical research into it at its 40th anniversary, have established a clear sense of the historical compromise character of all 16 documents in themselves, something that Bart references already at several points of his own questions. What is a matter of renewed controversy today among Roman Catholic theologians and within the Catholic episcopacy is whether the task at hand is a synthesis of these positions, according to the first principle of practical reason, pacta sunt servanda, or alternatively, the assignment of a privileged status for positions of discontinuity, so-called hermeneutics of rupture, forgetting or dismissing the agreed moments of continuity, perhaps demanding in the near future a purer Vatican III, or so a rejection of the Council as it was with all its terrible compromises and its complex reception. Addressing theological developments within the communities of the Reformation in recent years, Dahlke's treatment of how we can view Bart and the Council suggests how a fuller statement of ecumenical methodology would demand from us the identification and the serious, not necessarily the neutral, transparency and engagement of the spectrum of discussion partners on each side and within each side. The work by Congar, just cited, was written in the first 5 years after the Second World War, published in late 1950 after Humani Generis, and banned by the Roman authorities in 1954, in part at the urging of more antiquarian Dominican theologians. Following his intimate involvement at the Council, made possible by papal influence, Congar was able to publish a second version of True and False Reform in 1967. Congar regretted that he was compelled by this time, compelled by time restrictions, to reprint the third section of the study, The Reformation and Protestantism, with merely minor revisions. The English translation of the work saw itself forced to admit without compensation Congar's discussion of the Reformation as unnecessary for understanding Congar's discussion of true reform. While regretting the, quote, hints of polemic, end quote, in his own presentation of Protestantism, Congar makes clear that he is not in principle against every use of critical confrontation or even polemic, but he reverses quite precisely the three attributes that Nietzsche had associated with and celebrated in his brand of critical history, a history for Nietzsche that is willfully unjust, impious, and without mercy or grace. As Congar articulates his alternative, polemic, however, if it is accurate, loyal, and irenic, can be a form of dialogue. Congar here mentions only one theologian by name whose work he would especially have had to reconsider in a more adequate study of Protestantism. He would have, quote, nuanced here several stereotypic expressions, would have spoken more positively about the meaning of the church, about the role of ecclesial community in the reading of the Bible, about Karl Barth's current views, 1967. He would have presented somewhat differently certain Catholic views opposed to those of Protestantism, not so as to reject those which I have held before, but in order to expand upon them and nuance certain points. The ecclesiology that is implicit in this third part is not sufficiently expressive of Lumen Gentium's teaching on the people of God, a people gifted in its entirety with spiritual charisms, end of quote. It belongs, as I understand it, to the central goals of this symposium to take up the conversation where Congar indicated it should go, asking with reference to Roman Catholic and Reformational thought how Barth's questions for the Council and its reception might help us better to discern true from false reform in the Church, and as part and parcel of that, true from false forms of ecumenical dialogue. We can ask about what the content, the character, and the spiritual charism of Barth's questions at this threshold moment of the Second Vatican Council can tell us about an ecumenical conversation that is capable today of progress, precisely because it is accurate, loyal, and irenic. The first two of these attributes involve resisting the temptation to portray the discussion partner as being too distant or too proximate to one's own position to offer a distinctively viable form of living faith. The third attribute seeks to relate the other two. Taken together, the three qualities characterize what might be called relational ecumenism as an alternative to prominent forms of conversion or reductive convergence. With that, I come to these three characteristics of Barthes' questions: their justice, their piety or their loyalty, and even, surprisingly, their irenicism. Ecumenism and critical history, then, this section. Barthes' questions, first of all, in the quality of ecumenical justice. Critical history can fail by applying an unbridled exclusivist hermeneutic of suspicion, exaggerating the distance between the positions of the other and what one holds to be a more genuine understanding of the faith. Admittedly, any portrayal of what characterizes the other's grasp of faith will draw on its own sense of what distinguishes the other from itself. In our text, for example, it is impossible to draw too sharp a distinction between Barthes' questions of understanding the council and his critical questions about it. The former reflect the latter and prepare their better articulation. Without wanting to prejudice our discussions in the following days, my impression at this point is that Barthes' description of the council and the Roman Catholic self-understanding that it expressed never transgressed the demands of justice and accuracy, with the possible and not particularly polemical misunderstanding of Dignitatis Humanae. Perhaps we can deepen that in the coming days. More characteristic and less obvious, however, are the ecumenical opportunities that are first made possible by Barthes' more accurate comments about the intentions of the council and even the motivations of Dignitatis Humanae. They point to the difficulty of locating, among all the many accidents and properties of alternative traditions, something like the differentia specifica that truly separates one tradition from the others. When, and only when accurately described, the differences attended to address two distinct genre of features proper to that other community, features that the partner can, and other features that the partners cannot easily reform without forfeiting what has been characteristic of their manner of embracing the gospel. Each genus is of ecumenical importance, but even here the twin thesis seems evident and not especially hazardous. Corresponding to the two genera, the desire for self-reform and then the foregrip of its likely parameters or limitations are two essential constituents of genuine ecumenical encounter. We can explicate this ecumenical dynamic by listening to Barthes' general questions at the beginning of Ad Limine Apostolorum. Barthes had prefaced his sets of dual questions of understanding and critique about the 9 of the 16 documents of the Council with 7 general questions, not yet divided into discrete categories. In all but possibly the first 2 of these 7 general questions, Barthes seeks to explore thematically the accommodation or updating intended by the Council in its unfolding reception. He shows that he is well aware of the 2 lines of thought present in the conciliar texts, one with a greater attention and attraction to non-Catholic and non-Christian movements, and he points out the often overlooked parallels to disagreements within the communities of the Reformation and their own struggle for clarity, self-critique, and self-reform. Along the lines suggested by Dahlke and Congar, Barthes confirms that ecumenical dialogue demands an awareness of interconfessional differences on both sides of the table. Let me recall for you those 5 questions. What does aggiornamento mean? Accommodation to what? Was the main concern A, the renewal of the Church's theoretical and practical understanding of itself in the light of revelation on which it is founded, or B, a renewal of her thinking, speaking, and acting today in the light of the modern world? Or if both, in the interest of the pastoral task, which was it primarily? Of which of these 2 types of renewal will stress be placed in the period after the council? And finally, the 7th question, are the adherents of the progressive minority, progressive majority at the council who opt for the latter, for option B, aware of the danger that this might result in an undesired repetition of the errors committed in modern Protestantism? The issue here of accommodation that dominates all of these 5 questions, general questions, accurately and justly names an overarching issue at and soon after the Council, and it was one about which the Catholic awareness of contemporary Protestant responses, if you like, admonitions to I've sometimes stole that wonderful idea from Michael Root, who's saying somewhere, of admonition and affirmation, which I think is a very apt way to put two of the major interests of ecumenical dialogue. But certainly this accurate admonition, accurate description is the presupposition of admonition, and it bore a certain fruit at and hopefully even today after the council. Bart's questions here echo the admonitions of the Reformed theologian Lukas Fischer, died in 2008, on the problematic surrounding an initially naive restriction of the phrase signa temporum to the more welcome historical developments in the cultural and political communities of the modernity in which the faithful of the First World were living in 1965. They wanted to, at first, to restrict signa temporum simply to the signs of the times, which were signs of happy developments. Representing the World Council of Churches as an official observer at the Council since 1963, Fischer had been involved actively in the discussions around what would become Gaudium et Spes. He had articulated verbally and in writing his criticisms of the way in which this phrase, signs of the times, was being proposed in the drafts of the pastoral constitution. Fischer argued that the lack of recognition of the biblical ambivalence about such signs in the early drafts reflected a lack of ambivalence about evaluating the signs in our own times. Because the draft, quote, gives too innocent a picture of the world, it cannot mediate any real hope. This memorandum is about 6 pages long, and every sentence is quotable. You could make a calendar just of this one. In good part, on the basis of these and similar objections raised notably by Fischer in 1964, a compromise was sought. When no consensus could be reached on expanding and deepening the notion of the signa temporum, quote, I'm quoting here from Charles Merler, who was a participant and one of the first great commentators on this document, quote, the term was largely eliminated from the draft, surfacing in the final text of Gaudium et Spes just this one time, in the first paragraph of Article 4, where it is further qualified by the remark that these signs need to be read in the light of the gospel, end quote. The verb here, per scrutandi, was restored to the draft. It had been eliminated, emphasizing the need to examine critically the signs of the times in the light of the gospel. That was picked up in a surprising way by the German theologians, above all by Karl Rahner and Oswald von Neubräuning, and they brought this criticism to the German bishops, and as late as the last day of August of 1965, tried to convince the German bishops not to allow Gaudium et Spes to be published by the council, but only after reworking it after the council. But they lost, but it left us with a way to see certain features of Gaudium et Spes that we might otherwise have overlooked. And that was a gift given to Roman Catholic theologians to help them achieve a kind of self-reform in this regard. And it is still of value to us today in the discussion that's been renewed about the signs of the times. This admonition for Catholic self-reform from voices of the Reformed tradition, at least as it was articulated between Barman and the Council, continues today to offer a needed counterpoint to recurring Catholic impulses in segments of theology and the episcopate to perceive the signs of the times as the voice of God or societal facticity as a source of funds of normative doctrine. Now we have three fontes, with the societal facticity as number three. It is the admonition implied in the second part of Barth's final question on Gaudium et Spes, quote, where is here the prophetic function of the council to be found in the real problems that surfaced in the middle of the 20th century, end quote. It is a question, however, that post-Barthian Protestant theology will need to answer for itself. Lukas Fischer will later suggest that the Declaration of Barmen remained for Barth the model of ecumenical collaboration for the churches in the world of our times. The measured but cautionary word on the sources, standards, and limits of accommodation is communicated here as an admonition based on an accurate assessment of the other, neither glossing nor magnifying the distance separating it from needed self-reform. They name an area for self-critique and self-reform that was well within reach. Barth's questions here, however, touch on questions for the remaining two features of ecumenical collaboration as well. First, about the quality of ecumenical loyalty when the possibilities of growing conformity seem to have been reached, having reached their limit, and then about the quality of ecumenical relationality and its implications for the self-understanding of a Roman Catholic Church that seems to be in need of external admonition to reach her ideal center. Let us turn to these two other features of critical exchange. So Barth's questions on the quality of ecumenical loyalty. Critical history can also fail, just in the other direction, by applying an unbridled inclusivist hermeneutic of retrieving the insights of the other as mere approximations to one's own, exaggerating the proximity between the positions of the other and one's own sense of genuine faith. While Nietzsche had called for critical history to march right over all pieties by cutting off the past at its very root as no longer an option for the future, that is not the only form of impiety towards the other. The other can be eradicated by an excessive proximity not prepared or mediated by a prior awareness of distance, by a theoretical and or practical denial of the alterity of the other, which can lead in the end to the atrophy of the now non-relational self. I think that, again, that semi-secret evaluation by the papal council is a good example of that kind of tactic. Barth's Ad Limina Apostolorum does not include explanatory background to Barth's questions, and or for reasons of a more Roman than Reformational perception of discretion, deliberately do not report on the content of his recent Roman discussions. As Eberhard Busch tells us, Barth also, alas, soon set aside the passing thought of composing outlines or theses for counter-schemata or counter-decrees. But especially in the repetition of certain issues in his questions on the nine documents, Barth gives us a sense of where he sees a need for admonition, even on issues where consensus might prove to be more elusive. Barth's willingness to pose unglossed questions in Rome, unsure of their chances to move the partner to self-critique and self-reform, or alternatively, to elicit in that partner greater clarity of self-understanding, did not seem to diminish the overall cordiality with which Barth was welcomed at this threshold moment in Roman Catholic history. Such unharmonized topics, such as the place and significance of Eucharist and baptism for Christian existence, Barth's final volume in Kyrklicka Dogmatica on baptism would appear the very same year as Ad Limina, his questions on the primacy of Scripture in relation to tradition, magisterium, and such loci alieni as reason and history, his questions around ministry, especially the difference between the common priest of the people and something like a hierarchy, and with and beyond that, the place and understanding of the Church as sacrament and sacramental cause, and or as effective grace, the questions on Mary and what she has to say or not to say about ecclesiality as a whole, and the questions about the relationship of the parts of the Church to the whole. All of these questions come up at least five times and more in these questions. The longest questions involve the relationship of Christianity to non-Christian religions or the general idea of religiosity. They surface particularly in Barth's questions on Nostra Aetate and Dignitatis Humanae, but also in the questions he had prepared on what seems to be the document that most intrigued him, or at least displeased him, Ad Gentes, the decree on mission, unfortunately the only document that in the end was not discussed during the Roman visit. Barth's critical irenic questions, as he puts it twice, his critical irenic questions on these individual matters will be dealt with more closely by others in the discussions of the next 2 days. For now, it suffices to see where Barth's unglossed questions, polemical or not, aim at a critical use of history without succumbing to the temptation to march right over all pieties by strategies of exaggerated alienation or harmonization. Without diminishing the importance to ecumenism of Edinburgh in 1910 or the attempts at self-reform of the Vatican Council, the history of ecumenism and self-reform has a longer history. To take but one example, in his study of the ultimately unsuccessful ecumenical movement towards ecclesial reunion in the 17th century, notably that series of negotiations organized by Gerhard Walter Molan and Christoph de Rojas y Spinola, to which Leibniz came at an advanced stage of the conversations. Paul Eisenkopf distinguished the discrete ecumenical strategies articulated by Leibniz, and which were in good part responsible for the initial success and the ultimate failure of the negotiations. To these belonged, alongside self-reform and preliminary union, soon catabasis or condescendance, condescension if you like, or a very generous interpretation, and its chief tool, namely interpretation itself. In what was intended as a benevolent, if condescending, reading of the oppositions, each position was interpreted to appear as close as possible to its seeming counterposition. The grasp of the problem, however, was regularly lost without gaining much of use for either side. Neither Leibniz nor Molan appeared still to be aware of the proprium of the reformational theology of justification, so even someone like Krumweide says that, and critics on each side set about reiterating positions that they recognized had long been forgotten. With that, if very much unintentionally, interpretations based on excessive soon catabasis had made the path to unity that much longer and more arduous. This parabolic dynamic is not unknown in our own times. Many of the more vigorous reactions to the recent discussions on justification between Romans and Lutherans, before and after the joint declaration in 1999, have expressed frustration with the rigor with which the tripart template of initial misunderstandings, growing convergence, and present consensus on each major question was applied to interpret all potentially divisive issues, so much so that where the template appeared all too clumsy and artificial, notably in the issues of sacraments and ministry, the topics were simply withdrawn from the discussion table in regards to the implications of the doctrine of justification, that too from this as a recommendation in 1992 of the semi-secret evaluation of the papal council. The earlier intention was to deal not with those direct, just with those direct questions of justification, but also with sacraments and ministry. Older and more recent experience with the counterproductive effects of quasi and Leibnizian interpretive strategies of harmonization make it unlikely that a path to the common table of the Lord would be found by interpreting the opposing positions on Eucharistic sacrifice merely as a consequence of a misunderstanding of memoria prevalent in the 16th century but overcome in our own. A preliminary goal of theological dialogue loyal enough to other Christian communities to acknowledge in them remaining moments of alterity without resorting to something like conversion, which I think is behind Eberhard Jüngel's proposals in 1998, for intercommunion on the joint common basis of the Lutherans' sense of passive justification, passive ministry, and a passive conduct in the Lord's Supper, to merely pragmatic sanction or activism, which was the Roman alternative to that, or to the misguided soon catabasis, which seems to be the more likely approximation, there seems to be a more likely approximation to the unity of the body of Christ in theological conversation, a unity that Augustine had identified as the intended grace of the Lord's Supper. Both sides are in principle agreement about the axiom, Deus non alligavit potentiam suam sacramentis, God does not restrict his power to the sacraments. And that common conviction makes obvious the aggression of demanding of the other a Gastgeschenk, that the guests bring a gift of self-denial as the price for their ecumenical welcome. So Nicholas Schneider, head of the Evangelical Church in Germany in 2011. With that, I come to Barth's questions on the quality of ecumenical peace, the last section. The most sharply dialectical qualification of Congar's version of an ecumenically fruitful form of critical history comes with the coincidence of irenic and polemic. Irenic might seem also, at a distance, the least likely description of Barth's mindset in accepting the invitation ad limina apostolorum. He is skeptical of the kind of ecumenism that would see itself as a form of negotiated peace or trade agreement between two sovereign parties. The questions that Bart carried to Rome in his satchel were not of this, of the kind by which a peaceful refiguration or reformation of the partner could be affected or even expected. The invitations presented, the invitation to him to be an observer at the council and the invitation to visit after the council, presented a chance to bear theological witness to the gospel that both partners confessed. And so for Bart to see, first of all, how evangelical believers could better answer their own calling. But precisely because of this primary interest, Bart's interest in the council was also suited well to serve as a sounding board to chart just how far the conciliar examination of reformational convictions might lead the Roman Catholic community and to learn to what degree it was a reformed council. The stated purpose of Bart's questions was to sharpen, by comparison and contrast, the reformational search for where the Spirit was leading it. But we would miss the Irenic motive of Bart's initiative if we reduce ecumenism to the concordiae negotiated by more institutional ecumenical bodies with the magisterial authority that has often been a point of internal contention among the partners on each side of the table, in particular the authority of the World Lutheran Federation that was affirmed in the Common Official Statement and protested by that open letter in October of 99 by the Protestant community. Already, Thomas Aquinas knew that we need to distinguish between genuine peace and mere concord. We might say concords. Concordiae are agreements between two parties, urged at times by very external factors, even violence, while peace demands that hearts on each side attain what they long for. For Thomas, as for Bart, this irene, this peace, is possible only by the gift of each partner's growing conversion to God. Bart's rejection of the model of ecumenism chiefly as conversion from one confession to another implies also the rejection of a merely external convergence of institutions that would leave their members more indifferent to the source of their unity and so further behind on the path towards the peace which the world cannot give. In the negotiations referred to above for reunification of the churches in the 17th century, the initiators of largely political plans knew that they were the Irenicists in this business, and they named themselves as such without hesitation, qualification, or self-doubt. Although their failure to acknowledge differences within and between the confessions was a significant cause of continued division. Peace, as Augustine tells us, is tranquillitas ordinis, and it has been a legitimate, if elusive, goal of the remarkable ecumenical movement for the last 100 years to identify what kind of ordering should be sought, from organic unity to unity in a more or less reconciled form of diversity. Among Bart's contributions to the future of ecumenism should be counted his example of how, even prior to settling collectively on a definitive statement of ecumenical goals, without any overt or even latent decision that all open questions are to be declared incidental in the end, a genuinely amicable encounter is possible that can avoid the excesses of estrangement and harmonization. That gave Bart's ecumenical method something of an exploratory character, well expressed in the initial form of questions, none of which is entirely innocent. Despite his own initial willingness in 1963 to employ the term seiuncti fratres, Bart's many irritated references to the questionable implications of this term, including his ironic inclusion of the term in one of his book dedications for Paul VI, point to his deeper questions about the council's notion of church. These will be dealt with most likely in the talks on Lumen Gentium. So here, just a note. Although the council's use of the term subsisted is not discussed in Bart's question, his issue with the seiuncti fratres does seem to revolve around the degree to which the Roman Catholic community should be viewed as a part of the greater whole, which is the Church. Parallel to Congar's remark on the spiritual charisms, Bart asks about the ecclesiological implications of the fact that Catholicism has learned of the essential importance of ecumenism from the Protestant churches. As suggested above, the list could also be lengthened to include the need to scrutinize the signs of the times in and outside the church, the need to acknowledge an extrinsic source of grace, the great fruit of the discussion on justification, the end of the Ronarian period in Roman Catholic history, the non-identity of self-salvation and salvation through another, Christ as the first subject of genuine sacramentality, and the necessity of historical critical methods. Barth did not, in Ad Limina, provide an answer to the question suggested here, and in fact, the perfect piece of a final answer is not yet even today within our reach. Despite Barth's criticism of the conciliar call to devote extensive attention to Thomas Aquinas in its plans for the theological formation of priests, one further remark by Thomas on peace might be allowed here in conclusion. Thomas wrote that it is important to distinguish between perfect and imperfect peace and to pursue both. The eschatological reserve, which nevertheless encourages the pursuit of different levels of attainable but admittedly imperfect peace, implies the idea of the preliminary goals in the 17th century, if at that time not yet preliminary enough. They had a Gallican model behind it. It is not implausible that this idea of a preliminary, if imperfect, peace should motivate our activity with one another. Do not these genuine correctives and enrichments of major trends in Roman Catholic thought and practice, by the affirmation and admonition of reformational theologians, suggest as a fitting ecclesial model the totum potestativum, the potential whole, made up not of homogeneous but of heterogeneous parts, not all of which express the whole to equal degrees and about which we might continue to debate, but all, or at least several of which, in their heterogeneity, are needed for the whole to thrive. To be a locus of subsistence and to be a part in need of other parts are not mutually exclusive attributes. Until the perfect order of the different confessions to one another becomes clear, we will be ad limina, also in Victor Turner's sense of the betwixt and between, in a state of liminality. During that time, we will need, and I do mean need, to rely on friends who share and model for us the fides quaerim intellectum of the gospel, friends who are different enough from us to be for us and with us in justice, loyalty, and with a view towards an Irene which is not just of our own making. Thank you.
Paper, which contained much more than I could take in. One thing that I did take in, though, was that you're rather hard on the generation of ecumenists that over 30 years or so did the work that that led to the Joint Declaration on Justification, for having engaged in what, these are not exactly your words, is at once a naive and devious distortion of historical record. And at the same time, you stress the importance of encounter, a genuine encounter with the other. One of the things that's really striking about the people who are involved in this discussion over the 70s to the 90s, almost all of them are not gone, was the way in which they saw their genuine encounter with the other, from both the Catholic and, in the case of the justification issues, the Lutheran side, the way they saw that encounter as one in which their own assumptions about the other based on their own confession's depiction of the other were profoundly wrong. And they found in the other, whether Catholic or Protestant, a true, usually brother, occasionally sister, in Christ. So I wonder if it wasn't that depth of encounter with the other and the recognition of the other as one from whom the ecumenist was not in fact truly separated in faith, which then led to a kind of questioning about the possibility of misunderstanding within the two traditions or the various traditions of each other. I'm not sure how sweepingly you want to dismissed the possibility of historical misunderstanding between Protestants and Catholics. It sounded like you wanted to dismiss it rather obviously. You can correct me on that. But it seemed to me, at any rate, that there's actually a rather deep connection between this encounter, this genuine ecumenical encounter with the other, and a sense of having been party to a misunderstanding.
Okay, well, thank you. I mean, it does go to the heart of what I was talking about. And perhaps when the paper's there to be read, you'll see that I actually say that much has come out of that discussion. I think that the discussion on justification was perhaps even more fruitful than the document, and that the document was more fruitful than the marketing of the document. So there were great things. There was self-reform, certainly on the Catholic side, and I think on the side of reformational communities as well, and I think that was good. I mean, I think it was the turning point when you have Karl Lehmann editing a document that says, we believe that nature is never an existential, never just part of our nature, de facto nature, but it's always external. That means that, I don't want to call it the Ronerian captivity, but the Ronerian period of Roman Catholic theology that was certainly dominant between 1960 and 1985 was over. And so it was something that we learned from that. But I do think that this tactic of always claiming misunderstanding as your first step, which is in every one of the seven issues that they identified and justification in Lehre vom Urteil und Kirchentrennen, that caused a huge reaction of people who were working historically. And I think it, in fact, made the goals more elusive of coming together than if you had faced honestly a kind of, with the normal historical sense, that you find conflict there and you admit it, and then you deal with it from there. That would have been even more productive. When it happened, it was. Or where it happens, it's more productive. And I see it not just in the discussions that ended with 1999, but I see it up until today as a tactic. And I don't see any apology yet for the kind of Roman... There is a kind of Roman secrecy that gets on the nerves of our Protestant brothers and sisters. And you can understand some of that. I mean, that whole thing with that semi-secret evaluation was a low point in Roman Catholic methodology, I thought.
Thank you for your very deep and insightful talk. One thing you mentioned, you were quoting a theologian, and he said Marian devotion was a mausoleum. And just a brief question about that. Obviously, that was several decades ago. What is your take on Marian devotion today, which seems to be much different, and how can it help the different parties get together? As we know, we have scripture which speaks of Mary and many other things. So I was just wondering how those ideas in scripture about Mary and our tradition about Mary can help the two sides come to some more unity. Thank you.
Well, that would be a conference on its own. But I could just say that I think it's important to acknowledge where there is some difference and to see the ecclesiological ramifications of, you could portray Mary as simply being a witness and a receiver of the gospel, and that is certainly a huge part of what even Roman Catholics hold. But to say there's no dimension which doesn't somehow stress the kind of combination of activity and passivity that we heard about in one of the talks this afternoon, which I think characterizes such other conflicts such as Eucharist, would be wrong. And so I think you need to take the Mariology and, without exaggerating the distances, also not exaggerate the proximity of the two positions, but use it to say, where is there here a kind of distinction between two strains of Christian tradition? And that's where I would begin. And I think once you do that, you probably will get closer. But it's not by a kind of apodictic statement that people just misunderstood, or that even for the Roman Catholic community, Mary is dead. I just don't think that's really the way to go. Yeah. That theologian, by the way, is still alive. and writing memoirs. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your rich paper. I wanted to follow up perhaps a question that Bruce had started. I'm no expert on the Joint Declaration, so please correct me here. I had read those historical statements in a slightly different way. I had read them to say that the joint condemnations and anathemas of the 16th and 17th centuries belonged correctly to those eras, but they did not belong to the contemporary, the living communions that were now seated at the table across from one another, and that it was that move that allowed the breakthrough to say, now these groups that no longer face-to-face anathematize one another can make joint statement with different emphases.
I'd be curious, where did you see the part that acknowledged that in the 16th century that was well-founded?
Now, I'm just going on memory here. I thought that what they said in the Joint Declaration was that those statements belong to the era in which they were said, and though there could have been polemics and misunderstandings, those condemnations were part of the ecclesial understanding of the 16th century and belonged there and did not have to be repudiated.
Well, I think it was, I think it was this threefold tactic. They didn't really address each other then. They certainly don't address each other since then. They've become irrelevant. And even if they still might have a little bit of relevance, only in secondary issues. It was that threefold strategy, which was very deliberate in each of the seven issues on justification.
If I can comment on that, and I have the advantage and disadvantage of having been on the drafting team, the last two versions of the Joint Declaration.
Yeah.
And that's an advantage and a disadvantage in my own view, and it was 20 years ago. A point I was going to make in relation to your presentation, which is very helpful, is I wonder if you are conflating too much the condemnations, the therefore we're titling the study, and the Joint Declaration. There were certain respects in which the Joint Declaration deliberately distanced itself, without saying so, from the strategy of the therefore we're titling the study, particularly in letting the dead bury the dead, and not deliberately, I think it's either paragraph 43 or 44, and saying nothing about whether or not these condemnations did or didn't apply to any specific group or person in the 16th century. And so in paragraphs 40 and 41, it's quite clear that what the text says and the churches affirm was that the Lutheran position as described in this text is not touched by the condemnations of the Council of Trent. And the Catholic position on justification, and the Catholic position as put forward in this text, is not touched by the condemnations in the Lutheran confessions. So the strategy in the Joint Declaration there is, I think, rather different from the layer for retirement study. And so the threefold structure you talk about of past misunderstanding, etc., I mean, I have to go back and look at the text here with this question explicitly in mind. But it wasn't, the structure in chapter 4 with the 7 points is not historical at all. It's here's where we agree, and then here's a specific Lutheran spin or variation or detailed point and a Catholic position in the hope that the reader will see that the agreement is, in a certain sense, more overriding than the difference. So the strategy there is, I think, rather different from the layer for retiling and study, and to a degree was intentional on the part of the draft.
I'd mentioned what I think is the largest difference between the Declaration and the Lehrvorteilung study, and that is that the sections on sacrament and ministry have been removed. I think that's the major difference. What you're saying is more nuanced, and you know, if that would be a lesson that was learned and could be embraced from that document, that would be great. But what I see, for example, in today's discussion of a common Eucharist, is again that strategy of saying, well, they didn't have this category of memory, and therefore they really weren't contradicting each other. They just had this clumsy thing about sacrifice. And I mean, so I don't see that we've really overcome that strategy. I wasn't really interested in just talking about the Common Declaration. I use that as an example, but I'm worried about this strategy. And if we would learn the lesson because of the reactions that almost impeded the Common Declaration and certainly led to the great protest by Protestant theologians, including one who's here, at the just on the eve of the proclamation, then I would be happy. But I don't see that as being a lesson that everyone has learned yet.
And I will not defend every word there or sentence within the Joint Declaration itself. I think the Joint Declaration does give the impression that the remaining differences are ones of emphases or interpretation, and there was a debate within the group where some of us wanted to say more clearly. In some places, they just straightforwardly disagree, but we think within justification, these are disagreements that can be lived with. But that didn't carry the day, and you end up with an ambiguous sentence. And I certainly agree with you. This is something that, broadly speaking, ecumenism has not altogether learned. It's just that I do think there is a difference here. In some ways, the Joint Declaration was a bit more narrow. And I would say on the Lutheran side, which is the side that I know from that time, from the very first discussion, it was clear that we would only deal with the justification question. So on the Lutheran side, that was also quite clear from our discussions, that we thought the sacrament ministry material from the U.S. dialogue and from the Lehrvorteilung study was not ripe, so to speak, to move forward on.
That's new to me.
That was true on our side.
Application question. If the 16th century debate was around the sacrament of penance, Luther was trying to secure how can you be sure you're forgiven. Many today would say the debate is around the sacrament of marriage in the churches, especially around the issue of same-sex blessings. What have we learned in the last 500 years that we can apply to this particular moment in the history of the church? How would you apply, you know, given this wonderful taxonomy and the wisdom you've given, how would you say to pastors, church leaders, what are some things we don't want to do? What are some things we do want to do? And in the spirit of full disclosure, I'm an Anglican pastor, so this is a real-life issue for us.
Okay. Well, again, it would take a longer discussion. First of all, I think I'd violate my own tendencies here by pointing out that perhaps precisely on the Sacrament of Penance, there was a great deal of interest on Luther's side to keep something like that. The differences would be fascinating to look at. And I think one of the fascinating things about being in conversation with the Reformation, with the Reform side, is that their view of sacraments was even more critical than the Lutheran one or the Anglican one. Marriage was never considered a sacrament by any of those traditions. And so it would be harder to negotiate that on the basis of sacramentality. But one could bring in that whole issue that Fisher had raised and that Bart raises in his general questions about accommodation. You know, to what degree do we want to accommodate change and to what degree do we want to offer an alternative, a critique of it? And that would be perhaps the place to start. But it wouldn't really be a discussion, I don't think, directly of sacramentality.
Well, and I need to be a little more precise, and this is probably a conversation we can have offline. Sometimes in the Protestant tradition, the difference between marriage as a covenant and marriage as a sacrament is really hard for me to differentiate. but there has been a change in the teaching of the nature of marriage in recent years. And so, yeah, there's a sense in which they're not exact parallels, but I do think there's some application, simply because most Christian churches, traditions, they want their marriages to work. They want their marriages to flourish. They want their families to flourish, which is why a lot of Protestant churches have been enriched by John Paul II's theology of the body. They may not understand it very well, but they're reading it. They're trying to incorporate it. So there's a kind of ecumenism of the family and marriage already going on. So though the parallels aren't exact, I think there's something there crying out to be understood. I'm looking for help.
But I just don't know enough about that to really address it. I'm sorry.
I'm going to make this the last question.
Thank you very much, Father Richard. And I was wondering if you could connect your discussion about this, first the Lutheran Catholic dialogue and some of the remarks you made about Bart going to Rome and the different partners that he had to speak to, and recognizing that maybe there was a diversity of views about the council, and trying to figure out which one of these is the real, the authentic voice of the council, if I understand rightly the way you were putting it, and also the three senses of history. But to connect that back to the discussion we had about tradition earlier today, so tradition is a little easier for us as Catholics to get a handle on and to say, well, okay, the dialogue partner that you have today needs to in some way be representing the tradition in a faithful way. If, you know, you can't just hold yourself out as an authority and forget the tradition. And how does that work in ecumenical dialogue? How do you see it working with Bart? How do you see it working as Catholics looking at dialogue partners who don't have the same sense of tradition?
I think Bart would include me in his list of people to laugh at, that opposites are not always opposites, they're sometimes just differences. And I think certainly the way to look at the council is to identify the conflict, the continuity and the discontinuity conflict, and come up with a synthesis where both have their place. It doesn't happen automatically, and you can't even make a general rule for it. You have to look at each particular document and see where the conflict was, because they changed. I mean, Karl Rahner and the whole German theologians convincing the German bishops for 3 weeks to get the council to back off from Gallium et Spes because it's too optimistic, Rahner says. Karl Rahner. It's too optimistic. That's the influence that the Reformation, that the Protestant theologians had on the German. But of course, it was fact too that they were just 20 years out from the Second World War, and they knew that a lot of people with their consciences had done terrible things. But in any case, there's a need to synthesize. And I think, in fact, that's why those interventions, for example, are still interesting to us today, not in order to say, it would have been better had that never existed. That's not true. But to see in that document where those elements are that we can synthesize by saying we are closer to the times when we can sometimes stand against it. The world of 1965 was already over in 1968. No, and certainly in 1974 with the oil embargo, I mean, the end of this belief in unlimited technological progress was over. And I think that with Protestant help, the German theologians and to some degree the German bishops at the council recognized that before others, certainly before their French friends and theologians and bishops from France convinced them to go along with this. But I think, in fact, that that sense that there can be something broken about contemporary history is an important fact to hold, and I think that is something to be taken from that. And that applies, though, not just to the society out there, but also to the society in here, to the church out. It's also to the Roman Catholic community. We have to think about what it means that bishops can make mistakes and do, and theologians can make mistakes and do. And that whole tradition of self-critique, which is much stronger in the Reformed tradition than in the Roman Catholic one, is something we need to look at and see what we can learn from it. So that would be a point of growing convergence. So I'm not against every kind of growing convergence, Bruce.
Please help me thank Father Schiff.